Good morning. This is Amy Brown with a WERU special, Truth, Evidence, and the Media. This is a panel discussion that was held at Carleton College in Northfield, Minnesota on June 16th. The panelists were Carleton alums Eric Weifering of the Minnesota Star Tribune, Mary Stuckey, Executive Director of Round Earth Media, and John Greenman, a reporter for Maine Public and other media outlets before retiring and volunteering here at WERU. John Greenman was the first panelist to speak.
We are living in interesting times. There's no question about it. We're all concerned. Most of my broadcast journalism career has been in public television, and after that, after retirement, in community radio. I think there's no question that many who enter journalism, God, I wish I could say most, and it probably is between many and most, people who get into journalism do so to find the truth and maybe make a better world. I'm kind of hopeful about that. I think it's probably basically true. I think most of us are taking the current environment and the media that we find ourselves living with and the truth seriously. We are looking at all of this. I think we all are looking at it. Some of us are giving up, but some of us are still continuing to look. Former State Department Secretary Tillerson recently said, when we as a people, a free people, go wobbly on the truth, even on what may seem the most trivial matters, we go wobbly on America. This has crossed the line. He also said citizens must demand that America's future be fact-based, not based on wishful thinking, not hoped-for outcomes made in shallow promises. There are hundreds of news sources vying for our ears and our eyes, and especially our support. Now, how do you get the truth in all this white noise? Well, I've always thought that truth must be earned and re-earned. When the New York Times reports that weapons of mass destruction are hiding in Iraq, then eventually admits that it was wrong, it took some time before I was willing to trust the Times again. The problem is most news organizations pass on each other's stories, usually with attribution, and sometimes those stories aren't true, all of the truth, sometimes. Confirmation of facts is often impossible if the original source is anonymous. In the past, some editors refused to use anonymous sources. Maybe some still do, I don't know. Hopefully they'll answer this. But the 24-hour news cycle is relentless and the clock ticks. It's really tough. So I've been thinking about the problem of finding trustworthy sources for a long time. And while it's nice to think that you should trust but verify, how the hell can I verify? I have the same source as everybody else does. I can't verify. I'm a private citizen, for gosh sakes. I don't work in the industry anymore. So I threw the problem to friends and family. Yeah. Could you please take a moment to let me know how you feel about the news sources on which you depend and how you've come to trust them? Well, here's some answers. Although I occasionally watch Fox News, I mostly watch NBC, CBS, CNN, where I have never seen instances of intentional fake news. Deutsche Welle, DW, is great, and the Japanese do give an incredible, very good international weather service. Today's internet news promotes a certain level of intellectual laziness, making it too easy to get into a feedback loop that enforces one's own positions. I get zero from social media. I don't do Facebook, Twitter, or their ilk. Their pandering and money-making algorithms put too heavy a thumb on the scale. I should be doing this in different voices, but I make a point of occasionally checking the likes of Rush Limbaugh, but he is such a one-trick pony that little even changes with his pitch anymore over time. He's a modern-day Father Coughlin, preaching and reinforcing the message to the faithful. I'll even check out Fox and Hannity sometimes. I don't believe the New York Times simply because they are the newspaper of record. They helped get us into the Iraq War, so even with the Times, trust but verify. Good luck with that. A doctor friend of mine wrote, "News sources, consistency, reputation, honesty, CNN and Washington Post and NPR, anyone Trump despises." They are not perfect, but... And as for the marketing of news, one friend wrote, "Have you ever noticed how many news headlines aren't actually describing news, but instead are suggesting what might happen, what pundits think is likely to happen, or how a particular event could potentially affect the future?" And finally, this from a family member, "I haven't found any broadcast news that is truly trying to be informative. For printed media, there are similarly left or right positions taken according to the prejudice of the owners or executives. The changes at the Wall Street Journal when Murdoch bought it were particularly evident. It took on a much more conservative point of view. The weekly news magazines are the same. The only one I have found in recent years that seems to me to make an attempt at balanced news is called The Week, which reports several sides of the political spectrum intentionally in all of its reporting. So now, here are some of my sources. I use the Hourly News app, which I have on my phone, which gives audio updates pretty much every hour from Deutsche Welle, BBC, VOA, CBC, and a bunch of others. Fox, too. I get news alerts from the New York Times, Washington Post, Politico, and Google News. And for in-depth coverage of undercovered stories, I turn, as I'm sure many of you do, to Amy Goodman and Democracy Now!. She's unparalleled. I also watch Al Jazeera live stream on YouTube, which, by the way, gave uninterrupted live coverage and commentary from Singapore earlier this week for hours. It was amazing. And if you just don't have time to hop around among all these sources, the New York Times opinion page, which you can subscribe to, has links to a great variety of news, of views on different stories. And I get it every morning. One additional source, if all else fails and you've given up, Funny Times. Because we do indeed live in funny times. In 1967, public broadcasting journalists thought they had a heat shield when Congress set up the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. It provided a certain amount of funding to them with few strings attached, certainly fewer strings than commercial broadcasters face. But public broadcasting and even community broadcasting, while non-commercial, have always been a little pregnant. Remember this? Masterpiece Theater, brought to you by Mobil Oil. It's true, it's been there a long time. Enhanced underwriting has meant longer and more visually interesting spots before and after shows. The power of underwriters led to the cancellation of a couple of Bill Moyers programs and others. And that led to the eventual knowing of public broadcasting as the network of furs, fins, and feathers, safe. It happened. Funding of public and community broadcasting continues to be perilous. And I would remind you that funding provides the foundation from which the pursuit of truth can take off. At WERU-FM, community radio in Down East, Midcoast, Maine, there's not enough funding or volunteer power to go after daily news, so our journalism focuses on community needs, legislative activity, health, and other social concerns and issues that come and go in the course of a year at a time. We recognize that our world of community broadcasting is in transition. Not only are the demographics against us, our members are getting older and older every year, but more and more listeners are listening offline and are asking for podcasts and blogs. How will all the changes translate into continued support, if at all? Will our members stay with us? And what about our local underwriters, our foundation of support? Final thought, if you find sources you respect and trust, support them, subscribe, and keep them healthy. Keep them around. Don't let them disappear. You can't seek the truth and evidence for it when there's no support. And in the words of Edith Ann, and that's the truth.
Thanks, John. Oh, bravo.
Here.
How do
do you follow that?
You don't have to follow that.
You don't have to.
Oh, good. I thought it was me.
This is Eric Weifering of the Minnesota Star Tribune.
I have been a working journalist since 3 months after I graduated from Carleton, and I've worked at the very smallest papers you can imagine on Cape Cod and up to the Star Tribune, and I've worked at magazines. I've never worked in broadcast, and I've done everything along the way, from covering local school board meetings to being a business columnist and to my current job, where I run our investigations projects. I'm also kind of the wrangler for Sunday 1A, kind of the most important stories we do during the week for our Sunday print edition. I use the print conventions because it's what most people understand, but obviously we're very much a digital enterprise now as well. And, you know, so I have kind of, like John, lived through the thick of these changes. I will say that even in this current environment, the fundamental role that we have really hasn't changed, and our fundamental role, our obligations as journalists, have not changed. We inform, we hold institutions and officials accountable. And we, of course, entertain. I mean, if anyone's from Minnesota and they saw the story about the raccoon climbing the building in this week, the most popular story on every outlet's website, NPR quickly branded it the NPR raccoon.
Smart.
And so there is an entertainment component as well. But it's a very different environment. It's a much more fractured media environment, a much more splintered media environment. One of our very able competitors, the Pioneer Press, has just been really buffeted over the last 5 to 10 years by its ownership, which is a kind of a faceless private equity firm that is bleeding dry papers in St. Paul and Denver and in other places in the country. And, they still manage to give us fits, but they are their scale of ambitions are much more limited. So if you're a public official to some degree in some markets, you don't have to worry as much about having a reporter at a public meeting as much as you may have had to worry about when I got into the business. So the financial pressures in the industry have had very real consequences for the ability of the public to know what's going on. And yeah, I'm going to limit my conversations mostly to kind of regional, local coverage. We have two or three people in Washington, D.C., but we don't go to every Sarah Huckabee Sanders press conference. We rarely go to those. So we're covering our delegation out of D.C. We're not in the gaggle outside the White House every day. Our mission really is to serve our Minnesota audience as thoroughly as we can. And so my remarks are much more regional and less universal or kind of through the lens of what's happening in Washington. So it's much more fractured, it's much more splintered. Other ways it's different, our work is scrutinized much more closely than ever. And this is not necessarily a bad thing, as consumers of news now have, in a way that they didn't when I got into this business, direct access to primary sources, to papers, to reports, to SEC filings, in a way that you couldn't get 35 years ago. You couldn't get 25 years ago. We have to really be on top of our game. And of course, some of the people we cover and some of the institutions we cover, they have become outlets, media outlets themselves. They have Twitter, they have Facebook, they have their own web pages. And, to some degree, they're competing against us with obviously their version of events. But if a public figure has a press conference and the audio or the video of that press conference is on his website, or he's pumping out tweets with clips from that. That's something that the consumer of news can see directly in a way that they couldn't even 10 years ago, maybe 15 years ago. So, you know, we're aware of that. We know that we have to really be on top of our game, because if we aren't, we're going to get called on it right away. I mean, there's no, like, the letter that comes to the editor 2 or 3 days later. It's instantaneous, and that's a good thing. I mean, I think the power of the consumer to check what the media is saying is a good thing overall. The other thing I would say is that, of course, the pace and frequency of what we do now it's so dramatic. And when we have a breaking news event or a continuous news event, the reporters, they're tweeting or they're updating the story on the website constantly in real time. They're out in a scene calling into editors who are rewriting the tops of stories. So if it's a big story like a Philando Castile story, he was a gentleman who was shot in a very controversial stop by police in the village of St. Anthony. He was shot, and that happened at 9 o'clock at night, my memory of the exact time. Between 9 p.m. and 3 a.m. that night, we had 24 different versions of the story on our website. You know, while we're still trying to do the print version as well. So that pace, that competition, that sense that, you know, readers want to know it, and they want to know it right away. They don't want to wait until tomorrow to see what the story is. And so you have to be fast, and that puts pressure on being accurate and being fair. It does give you the ability to correct right away, and that's something that happens with a lot of frequency, you know, as we get more details. I think the expectation of the audience has changed too, that they don't necessarily expect the complete story on the first flash. But if you don't have that first flash, they're going to go somewhere else to get it. And it's a matter of economic survival these days. You have to compete to get at the top of the Google search algorithm. If it's a story that everyone around the country wants to know about, Al Franken's resignation, a raccoon climbing a tower, you want to be near the top of that Google search. And because it is unbelievable how much that influences the kind of traffic you get. Similarly, you know, what they used to call, I don't know if they still do, what the link economy, and that is social sharing of your stories through Facebook, through Twitter, through whatever other platforms are emerging, Snapchat. That's become vitally important to any media outlet. What I will say to that, though, is it hasn't caused us to lower our standards. We don't do certain kinds of stories because we know they're going to get a lot of eyeballs. Do we think of traffic when we're doing stories? Absolutely. When we're doing our page one lineup, does what's been driving traffic through the day have some influence on that, or is it part of the discussion? Absolutely. But, you know, you could write, you know, three teacher having an affair with student stories, and those would be your top story on your website every day, but they rarely make it into our newspaper on A1, for example. So it's something that as mainstream media outlets shift to a digital platform and a digital-only life, that they have to be aware of traffic. But we know that, you know, breaking news stories gets eyeballs to your page, but it is sustained and deep and continuous coverage of the most important institutions that bring people back and turn visitors into subscribers. And that's kind of one of the things that I work on, is that sort of deeply reported enterprise. And that can be deeply reported enterprise that runs the next day, as you saw, as some of you may have seen with the story about Hennepin County Medical Center and Minneapolis police giving people who are already restrained shots of ketamine, and basically using these people as test subjects for this drug. That's the kind of enterprise that we know turns visitors into subscribers. Probably the biggest change is the suspicion or outright hostility that the media encounters these days. You know, when I was first at the Star Tribune, and anyone who's from here might know that it's kind of was jokingly called the Red Star, because the editorial pages were so liberal. And even as a reporter, you would encounter that with sources, but it was always kind of an affectionate sort of, yeah, we know what you guys are about. But it was mostly directed about the editorial pages. These days, the whole, the fake news, the enemy of the state, that's much more sinister, much more ominous. And it has had, there very definitely has been a trickle-down effect. I mean, what's ironic here is it was the media that came up with the term fake news to describe what was happening on Facebook or in social media with Pizzagate and everything else. It was appropriated by or misappropriated by the president, and to describe any story that he just did not like, that was unfavorable. And now it has trickled down to, you know, we hear someone at the Shakopee Valley, at the Shakopee City Council, railing against fake news in the Star Tribune. And it's just news that he doesn't like, presenting facts that are incontrovertible that he or she doesn't like. And this notion that we are that we are in opposition to the interests of our readers is really, it's a troubling thing. I don't have a sense of how deeply it's taken hold, but you know, there have been studies and analysis that show that if you have a certain political viewpoint, even when you're presented the facts, it doesn't matter. It will only harden your viewpoint. And I'm not quite sure how we sort of counter that, except that, you know, our journalists have run into some pretty hostile settings and at times been a little bit fearful, and it's made them, these are mostly younger reporters, kind of question, should we be doing our job differently? Should we be changing how we talk to people? Should we be more advocacy oriented? And we have had, some of our reporters have been involved, for example, in the gay marriage movement. This is just going back a little bit. Mm. Or they take political positions on Facebook. And we've had to really tell them they can't do that. They cannot do that, because you cannot give your audience any reason to think that you are not doing your job as fairly as you can. It's the role of people like me, and you know, I guess what I would say is the difference between us and Facebook is we are a publisher. We do curate content. We do apply editorial standards. Facebook is not a publisher. They are not a publisher. They ultimately don't care about what the truth or the factual basis of what they put on their website, because that's not the business they're in. Their business is getting as many eyeballs to their website as frequently as possible, and then charging for every impression. We have ads. We charge for ads. We don't run fake stories in our newspaper or on our website. We apply editorial decisions. Now, there are wire stories that come to our website. We don't have as much editorial control over those. But I tell you, we do have discussions about which is the best story about Paul Manafort's being sent to jail, in terms of which is the best story in terms of apparent sourcing or alternative voices in that story. So it isn't just we take what comes to the website through the wire services that we subscribe to. So it's a different world, very much so. It's a much more frantic media environment, but I really do believe that the core of what we do has not changed. It may be more important that we adhere to those values than it ever has been, it's something that, at least in our newsroom, it's clearly understood what our obligations are, and we continue to pursue them. Sometimes, even if it means going to court more frequently than we've ever had to in the past, to get stuff that used to be public being made private. Thank you.
You're here.
Thank you.
You're here.
You're listening to WERU-FM. This is a WERU special. It's a discussion of truth, evidence, and the media that was recorded in June at Carleton College in Minnesota. The panelists are Eric Weifering of the Minnesota Star Tribune, Mary Stuckey, Executive Director of Round Earth Media, and John Greenman, a reporter for Maine Public and other media outlets before he retired and started volunteering here at WERU. Mary Stuckey.
Thanks. Wow. Appreciate what you had to say there. Again, I'm going to have to repeat a few things. Eric works for a media outlet. I founded and lead a nonprofit journalism organization that produces content, journalism, I hate the word content, by the way, that produces journalism for media outlets. And in our case, all of our journalism comes from outside the U.S., unless there's a direct connection with international, in the case of, say, reporting on immigration. We've won the biggest awards in journalism, including a Peabody for our broadcasting on our stories on migration issues out of Honduras, which seems to be an eternal story. We won the Peabody a few years ago. I've been a journalist ever since I graduated from Carleton, actually even before, since I had internships in journalism while I was here, and mostly reporting for National Public Radio in the glory days of journalism with a brief stint at the NBC TV affiliate here. I created Round Earth in 2005 to cover stories about issues and from places in the world that weren't getting attention, and especially now in an era of shuttered newsrooms, shuttered foreign bureaus, shrinking newsrooms. When I came to this town, Eric, I think the Minneapolis Star Tribune in the late 70s, early 80s had 5 foreign bureaus just for that paper. So we cover the world for top media outlets globally, which include papers like the New York Times and broadcast organizations like NPR, and top media outlets in the countries where the stories are occurring, assuming a free press. Adding to all of that disruption, in other words, the business model of journalism disrupted by the internet, the need for an organization like Round Earth Media, which is, you know, funded pretty much the way public media is, with foundation support, individual contributions. The need for that, the disruption of that, has now been exacerbated by this idea of fake news. And the fact that this room is as full as it is so heartening to me. You know, so many of us who work hard to report based on, you know, facts, and there is such a thing. Sometimes we worry about what's happening out there with our audiences. So thank you I shouldn't be surprised you're all Carl Grants, but still, you know, it's really great. I love to do this because I see the concern in your faces and I see your interest. So when a president lies, we repeat the lie in order to set the record straight. Increasingly, I'm hearing journalists and others say we should stop doing that. I frankly doubt that's an option. But there is a danger in that, because the more you repeat it, the more it gets out there. So it's something that we're grappling with. I mean, just I want to share some of the things that we're, you know, journalists like us, are grappling with. You know, how do we go forward in this era we're facing today? You know, even when we, as both Eric and John said, even when we expose a lie as a lie, much of our audience doesn't believe us. You know, they think that we're the ones lying. This is really new territory. And I think we're still not sure as a profession exactly what to do, except, as Eric said, to keep doing what we've always done. You know, it's not, this whole landscape, this whole environment may have changed, but essentially what journalists do, we may have different technology, in which to do it. A lot of it may be appearing online, but the way we go about our jobs, and frankly, as Eric said, the access to information, it really had, you know, if anything, we have better access to information online, easier access. I used to have stuff couriered to me, and, you know, could I get it fast and read this thing? And, you know, now you just, you Google it and you've got it. So all of that said, there does seem to be a real confusion about what our role is as professional journalists. And it's sort of still surprising to me, but it's out there, and I don't know if you all feel it, but I think there is, like, well, what does Eric do? Or what is Mary, you know, what do we do as professional journalists? I never in my life expected to see a reporter's email records and phone records seized by the Justice Department of the United States. This is serious stuff. And our media outlets are going to fight it, and we're going to fight it, and we're not going to just let this happen. That said, I think it's our job as journalists to explain better to our readers, our supporters, our listeners, and all of you, you know, how we go about our jobs. You know, what do we do? Like, peek behind the curtain. And I think a lot of us grew up at a time where, you know, you never used the pronoun I in a story. You never really revealed all the extra stuff you went through to get to the place where you are. I think some of these podcasts that you're listening to now, and I know you're all hooked on some of them, are kind of pulling that curtain back and letting you see a little bit more how we go about our jobs, the process we use. And I don't think that's a bad thing. So as I said, our reporting is based on verifiable facts. Verifiable facts. Not opinion, not conjecture, not anecdote. Okay? There is such a thing as objective facts. Objective, dare I even say, truth. And it may sound simple, but it's very, very, very hard work for us to get to that. We strive for it. We don't always achieve it. So what are facts? What are facts? They are based on documents, on data, on more than one person, I say three to my teams, who goes on the record saying the same thing. We don't use unidentified sources unless we absolutely must and can convince our readers or listeners why we did that. Okay, so that's hard, but it's essential to democracy. It is not our job to be popular. It's not our job. And I think a lot of people, maybe even at the highest levels in the White House, are confused about what our role is. One of my favorite Supreme Court decisions, and anybody who saw the movie The Post, did people see The Post? Okay, so you'll remember when Meg Greenfield, who was a hero to me, you know, one of the few, which I think she was the only woman in that newsroom at that time. And I grew up reading Meg Greenfield, you know, as a kid. She stood in that newsroom on the phone and read the decision in the New York Times New York Times versus the United States, the so-called Pentagon Papers case. And this is the Supreme Court Justices Black and Douglas. Here we go. In the First Amendment, this is from their concurring decision, the Founding Fathers gave the free press the protection it must have to fulfill its essential role in our democracy. The press was to serve the governed, not the governors. The government's power to censor the press was abolished so that the press would remain forever free to censure the government. The press was protected so that it could bear the secrets of government and inform the people. Only a free and unrestrained press can effectively expose deception in government. That's at risk today. That's at risk. The U.S. just dropped in its press freedom rankings, at least in part, because of the administration's assault on journalists, including moves to license and monitor us. All right. Part of the problem is that we've made a lot of mistakes, we journalists, right? So it's sort of like, well, who gave them all that power? They've screwed up. And we have. We made really big mistakes and catastrophic ones. We have contributed to bad political decisions. Covering elections as horse races is generally not conducive to democracy. But all of that said, all journalists and media outlets are not the same. So important. Breitbart is not a news organization. Facebook is not a news organization, despite the fact that they call it a news feed. Drives me nuts. They don't seek out the facts. I mean, Eric explained this perfectly. NPR, The New York Times, and other outlets that we work with do have that as their goal, despite the fact that they often screw it up, right? So these false equivalencies are really something to pay attention to, right? The New York Times and Breitbart are not the same thing, and social media and the internet have exacerbated these false equivalencies. Okay. There's a really interesting new book called Bunk by a guy named Kevin Young. And he talks about how do hoaxes start? What creates a hoax? Or what creates fake news? Or what creates rumors? And he concludes that they prey on our fears and stereotypes. Okay, that goes for liberals. It goes for conservatives. I know y'all who are on Facebook, good for you, staying off. You know, have seen that both on both sides of the political equation. You know, these stories that sort of play into your deep, you know, generalized assumptions or beliefs, and oh, that's so good. And you know, take a second look at where these things come from. Who's putting this stuff out? I've never been fooled by Facebook. Because as a journalist, I always look at the source. And it's been pretty, you know, who wrote it? I mean, I drive my friends crazy. They tell me about something they read, and I'll say, who wrote that piece? And they're like, who wrote that piece? I don't know. I didn't pay attention to the byline. You know, that's my thing, and I'm sure Eric does. I mean, we all do that. We pay attention to the byline. We pay attention to the media outlet. And when I see something, I mean, I can't even think of these things on Facebook, but it's just so obvious to me. Like, it's not something reliable. I mean, as much as I may laugh or think it supports or, you know, somehow is clever in its support for my personal political views, right? So take a very close look, and you guys can figure it out. So what's to be done? You know, we talked about how not that much has changed, really, about how we do our work. That said, I do think that we have to work harder than we ever have. We have to talk more in venues like this about what we do, and we have to be braver than we've ever been. The disruption of the business of journalism hasn't made that easier. In terms of international news and my teams, the majority of these teams are freelancers. Nobody's staffing foreign bureaus. Well, people are staffing foreign bureaus, but not as they used to. And so what we have are people who are really eking out a living. Often they're multilingual, versed in languages, versed in an area studies, so versed in the Middle East or in East Africa or whatever. We work with these folks, but they're operating so close to the bone financially as individuals. They hardly get paid anything by the news outlets. You often don't even know when you read the New York Times that that's a freelancer who wrote that piece and got paid, you know, not that much for the story. But that's okay because they're doing great work and we need them. That said, the financial pressures are enormous, and this doesn't help. You know, it doesn't help us do great work, and it doesn't, obviously, you know, you got to have money and time to do the kind of, what we're doing primarily is not investigative as Eric tends to do, but explanatory journalism, which is just as important, you know, to explain something, to connect the dots. Okay. Let's see. I'm not going to talk forever because I want to hear some of these. The other problem we've got right now is this notion, and again, going back to the post, because I'm sure a lot of you saw it, remember when Ben Bradley said, and he did say this, you know, that he didn't give a darn whether his reporters were banned from every White House press conference forevermore? They were going to publish. Okay, that's access, Reporters want access. They don't want to be banned. And so we need very, very brave editors, and we need very, very brave reporters. This is why I talk about that, who are going to be willing to publish regardless of whether X public official may cut them off. And it's a very competitive business right now. And this is a real issue. Last but not least, especially journalists from countries where we're reporting risk their lives in the interest of finding and telling the truth. This is incredible bravery in terms of doing what we do. I don't think we can say the same thing for people affiliated with some of these outlets that really aren't news outlets, like the Breitbarts, and there are many others, InfoWars. In terms of what you can do, again, what I said about getting smart about what you're seeing on Facebook, realizing that Facebook isn't a media outlet, the Pope endorsing Trump went viral because of the way Facebook works, which is what Eric described. So be savvy to that and look at those sources. I just want to take a minute as I talk about the bravery of so many journalists who die in the pursuit of the truth and of facts. In the last 25 years, 2,000 journalists internationally have died doing their jobs. The British-Irish freelancer Iona Craig just won a Polk Award, which is one of journalism's highest honors. And for years, she covered Yemen. For years, she covered Yemen, which, according to almost everyone, is one of the most forsaken places on earth these days. It's a gorgeous country, or was, which is being devastated by a proxy war between Iran and Saudi Arabia, and it's a war in which U.S. weapons and ordnance are helping to flatten that country. Poynter and others and the Polk Award praised her determined, difficult, and unflinching writing from rarely covered Yemen. She went to a village and encountered horrors from what President Trump called a highly successful Navy SEAL raid. Not so highly successful. She went boots on the ground to find out the truth. It's what we do at Round Earth. You check it out. You find out what really did happen. And in receiving her award, Craig thanked, quote, "the people who opened what was left of their doors to me and told me their stories."
You're listening to WERU-FM. This is a WERU special. It's a discussion of truth, evidence, and the media that was recorded in June at Carleton College in Minnesota. The panelists are Eric Weifering of the Minnesota Star Tribune, Mary Stuckey, Executive Director of Round Earth Media, and John Greenman, a reporter for Maine Public and other media outlets before he retired and started volunteering here at WERU. An audience member asked the panel why hosts of shows like Meet the Press don't use their access to public figures to ask them tougher questions and challenge them to provide evidence to support their answers. Mary Stuckey.
The access issue is an issue. Do you guys all get what I'm saying? In other words, you don't want to offend, tick them off too much, or you won't get them to come on your show. Yeah, I think it's one of the ways in which we failed you guys. Is not doing that, and not saying, that's a lie, or covering politics as a horse race, right? I mean, that's kind of what you're saying. I haven't watched that show in so long. Sure, Eric, have you?
No, it's my guilty, a guilty point in my career. I probably haven't watched that show in 25 years, 30 years, but I will say that show, based on a lot of other things I subscribe to, people are, the establishment political figures who appear on that show are not being dragged onto that show. This is very much an opportunity in their minds. They come in,
with a script of talking points. And because they see it as an opportunity to market the administration's viewpoint or to counter whatever may be going against the administration's preferred narrative at that previous week. And just to be clear, this is not something just the Trump administration has done. The Obama administration wanted to be on that show, you know, figures from the Obama administration wanted to be on that show just as readily as figures of the current administration. And as someone, you know, when you've got someone who comes in with a script of talking points, they've been trained. They're not going off those talking points. And getting someone off of talking points is one of the most exasperating exercises to go through. And when it happens, when the figure who's doing the asking decides, I'm going to get you off your talking points, it can make entertaining television. It isn't always informative television. I mean, the one episode I saw or one scene I saw, I think it was Stephen Miller was on that show. You know, and it degenerated into a big food fight on air, which is probably good for ratings, and I'm sure that video got a lot of viral sharing, but just because you've determined, I'm going to get this person off of his talking points, and every politician from the President of the United States to the Ward 11 council member in Minneapolis has talking points when they come into a media setting, and some of them are just much better at sticking to them than others. So it's the constraints of the format. It's kind of the ground rules that, or the expectations of the people who go on that show versus what the hopes and dreams of the audience might be. One reason I stopped watching it was I didn't feel like I was learning a lot from this show. You know, if you're a diligent consumer of news during the course of the week, I didn't feel like I was getting anything more from that show. But I don't want to sound like, you know, Chuck is very good at what he does, but it doesn't serve my needs.
Another audience member brought up Comedy Central and mentioned that although she enjoys it and finds it effective sometimes, she also thinks that sometimes it's maybe considered fake news. Mary Stuckey.
I don't know if you realize the New York Times is now putting last night's Daily Show on their daily news briefing that, you know, you get in the morning. They're putting on what happened last night on those shows on their daily news briefing. It's really amazing. I don't know. I still prefer, and I spent my career mostly in broadcast, but mostly in public media, so NPR, et cetera. I still prefer reading. And I want you all to read, as opposed to watching CNN or, I mean, you know, I love Almond Poor. I think there are great journalists working there, but read, and read a lot. Don't just read one source, right? The Intercept is doing some really extraordinary journalism, if you all don't know about that outlet.
The Intercept.
And this gal who reporting from Yemen that won the Polk Award, that was for reporting that she did that was published in The Intercept. So.
Okay. Could I just add one quick comment on
John Greenman
on comedy, because comedy is really effective. Irony, all the different realms that comedy takes. You get the information out, and I don't think in many cases it's fake news. It's just another way of interpreting and listening and hearing what happened. And you all and I get to absorb that, you know, hearing it from a different place. Watching all the different times, all the many, many times a certain realm of people repeat the same talking point over and over and over. You know that it's been planned. It's comedy and it's ironic and all the rest. And it's not fake. It's just a different way of understanding what is happening oftentimes.
The next question was about how entertainment gets the attention and ratings in the news world and how media outlets deal with that. The questioner specifically mentioned that he thought that Trump's rallies were considered high entertainment value during the campaign, and as a result, they may have gotten more attention than more serious aspects of the campaign did. He also mentioned a raccoon video that was talked about earlier in the talk as receiving a lot of hits and a lot of attention in the media.
It's not new. It's not new. Back in the 80s, when I worked at the NBC affiliate here in town, we'd come out of a made-for-TV movie, say, on a nuclear winter, and the lead story had to be about that subject, okay? And we took that, I wasn't really doing those, but that went from number three to number one. It worked. So the whole, I don't know what you guys think, but that whole entertainment versus news deal, it has been around forever. Maybe worse now, but not new, right?
Yeah. Yeah, and now politics is entertainment.
Eric Weifering.
The last campaign was a perfect example of that. Politics as theater, politics as spectacle. And it played right into Donald Trump's hands. The guy was, as an old business reporter, I kept telling my wife, there's no way he's going to get elected president. He was a failed businessman, not a successful one, and just a relentless self-promoter, and people will see that. But my brother voted for him. So he got elected. One of the things we learned from that, and, a couple of people mentioned this earlier about the New York Times and getting us into the Iran-Iraq war. Mm. With Judith Miller's reporting on weapons of mass destruction. What I will say in the Times' defense is it is tough when your sources lie to you, and because, when if you don't have a document, or if the document is fabricated, and this is a source that has been trustworthy over the years, and they lie to you, willfully lie to you, that puts every reporter, it's their worst nightmare. It absolutely worst nightmare. Now, could there have been editorial checks, better editorial checks against that happening once they had that lie in front of them? Absolutely. But I will say in the Times defense, they corrected it. It was a public flogging of themselves and of the reporter, much as it was with the Jason Blair case. Everyone holds up the Jason Blair case as an example of how you can't trust the Times. But the Times ultimately figured that out and very publicly corrected themselves. It's a painful thing for a media outlet to do, but that's the one thing I will say. Every journalism outlet makes mistakes, and they do things wrong. And nobody regrets it more and is more embarrassed about it than the reporter who made that mistake or his or her bosses. It is, and it can be as something as little as a misspelling a name to obviously saying there's weapons of mass destruction when there aren't. But no reporter is ever proud of making a mistake. And the bad reporters are the ones who refuse to, and the bad outlets are the ones that refuse to acknowledge they made a mistake.
Or reporters who fabricate, which Janet Cook and others have,
The panel was asked to comment on why the media continue to provide access to politicians who refuse to answer their questions. Why give them the opportunity to share their talking points if they're not going to answer questions?
I'll let you do that one. That's a tough one. That's a good question.
I think there are two sides of the access equation. One is that that reporters tread softly because they don't want to lose it. And that may be, I've never been a Washington reporter. I don't know how much that, so I've never had to live that experience. I've had to supervise reporters who were threatened to be cut off by local officials because they didn't like kind of the aggressive nature of our coverage. And the way they would do that, the way they would, quote, punish a reporter was leak news to a competitor.
That's right.
And that's what they do. That's the game they play. And you know what? Sometimes a reporter can get all twisted up in knots about it, but we don't cave. I've had mayors calling me wanting to sit down and take a reporter off a beat, and I won't even meet with them. Sometimes you have to ask people a question, and their non-answer, their non-answer may be this long, and you use a sentence of it. But there are some people you have to ask them a question. I mean, because the reader will demand, why didn't you ask this person this question? And their non-answer, in a way, to some readers may be revealing. But it's not, we don't see ourselves as kind of a platform that politicians can use to, you know, further whatever views they want. I mean, we do try and hold them accountable, but sometimes they won't answer a question. You have to answer, ask them a question, and they won't answer it in a truthful way, and you can poke and prod whatever way you want. I mean, it's, you're writing a story for tomorrow, and you got to get something. But
and the final question we have time to include today was one concerning whether the panelists have fears for their safety and their family safety in the current political climate, which of course has included Trump calling the media the enemy of the people, and whether they are, as a result, taking more steps to be private about their own political leanings and participation in politics, if any.
Are you more sensitive to that today?
Always have been. I've always been really careful, really, really careful. I stopped covering local politics here when my husband ran for office. I've been real careful, and I force my teams to be careful. Freelancers are in a tough position because they have to make a buck, and sometimes they will write something for a think tank or what have you. I want to know that. It's in their contract with us that they must divulge that, and then I take them off anything that, you know, might be related to that. And in terms of danger, yes, I have journalists right now who are in places of great danger, and we worry about them all the time. We have methods of checking in with them regularly, but it's a dangerous profession, especially outside the U.S. right now.
I don't think I've never had a yard sign in front of my house ever in my career. I've never given money to a politician or a political organization.
No.
It's just the way I've always lived. I think the challenge for some of the younger reporters we've hired over the years is that social media is such an ingrained part of their life, and Facebook. You know, we like reporters when they use Facebook to promote their own work, their own stories. But it's that, where do you draw the line between personal and professional? And so that's where we've had conversations with reporters, mm-hmm. is what they're saying on Facebook, what they say on Twitter. Anyone who covers politics for us at the State House, we know that their political opponents, whether it's the current governor or someone who's going to be running for governor, they're subscribing to their streams, they're monitoring every single one of their posts, and when they see something, I'm one of the first people who hears it. Mm-hmm. And so we've had to have conversations with reporters about that. But in my case, it's no change in behavior.
Yeah, me either.
And I can't even imagine what Mary has to worry about every day with reporters where she has them.
Was it Nat Hentoff who said, when you become a reporter, you put on a white robe, and that defines you. You become totally a different person. You have to, if you're going to be a reporter, or an editor, I guess, too, you've got to have that separation. And I'm lucky enough to be on the outside looking in, so I have had political slides.
Have you? Oh, gosh.
Now I'm at the outside, I can do that.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you all.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks for coming.
You've been listening to a WERU special. This discussion of truth, evidence, and the media was recorded in June at Carleton College in Minnesota. Our thanks to John Greenman, WERU volunteer and member of the panel you just heard, for providing us with this recording, which was lightly edited to fit this time slot. The other panelists were Eric Weifering of the Minnesota Star Tribune and Mary Stuckey, founder and executive director of Round Earth Media. I'm Amy Brown. Thanks for listening, and please keep it tuned here for On the Wing, coming up next here on your community radio station, WERU-FM, 89.9 Blue Hill, 99.9 Bangor, and streaming online at weru.org.